This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. The Coeur Sound in North Carolina is a place by itself. The people who live there are the keepers of a unique culture that has evolved over centuries. And because of their remoteness and their fishing industry, the people of Coeur Sound have always needed, as you might expect, boats. And although in 2013 the fishing industry is declining on the coast, the boats themselves still hold a great deal of memory for the residents of Coeur Sound. Larry Early is a fine art photographer and a writer based in Raleigh and the author of a photographer in a new book called The Workboats of Coeur Sound. He's my guest right now, Larry Early. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Pleasure to be here, Frank.
Tell us about the sort of the when and the why when you first started traveling from Raleigh to Coeur Sound. What brought you there?
Well, probably what brings everybody down there is the beaches first, over Atlantic Beach, for example. And then tiring of that, for example, taking a side trip, and I'd always wanted to go out all the way to Cedar Island. I'd never made it that far. This is back in the 80s now we're talking about. And so I started to take pictures on that very trip. It was just a day trip, and I took a few snapshots, basically, little scenics, a couple of boats here and there. But that's when it all started.
And so, and locate it for us and describe the topography and the unique conditions.
Yeah,
most
people know Beaufort, North Carolina, and if they continue along 70 and cross the North River and head out about 30 miles to Cedar Island, you're passing a very low-lying piece of land. On one side, you have Coeur Sound, which is very shallow, and on the other side of that, you have the Coeur Banks, which is a strip of barrier island. And the island, the peninsula itself, is separated by a lot of bays and creeks. So basically, you have a lot of chopped up mainland or soil land mass separated by various water bodies. So that's what causes some of the local remoteness, of those villages out there.
Very isolated place, and of course, then developing their own techniques. So who lives there, and how long have those folks been living there?
Well, I know that Atlantic, where I spend most of my time and documented a lot of the boats out there, says the people there say that some of their earliest forebears came in the early 18th century. So it's almost 300 years we're talking about that people have been out there. And then over time, certain families have kind of generally clustered together and developed. So I'd say for a couple of centuries, at any rate, they have been fishing and farming, trying to farm. It's not very great soil, a lot of wet soil, as you can imagine. But
and pretty fickle weather,
I would think. Exactly. A lot of hurricanes and nor'easters and that sort of thing.
So fishing has always been the primary industry, and boats obviously very important. So boat building is critical in that part of the world. Right?
Absolutely, yeah. As I said, they would farm, but most of the produce that they got and most of their other products were gotten in trade from the fish that they made or the oysters that they harvested. And they'd go to Beaufort, or they'd go up the Neuse River, out Pamlico Sound, and up the Neuse River to New Bern. So they were far wanderers in a way. Their economic web was spread pretty far.
All of this we can get by intuition, anybody who's been in sea communities and island communities. But then you saw this exhibit in Harker's Island that really got you to pay attention to those workboats, right?
Yeah. Actually, it's my own exhibit of boats that I some of the pictures that I had taken back in the 80s. I was asked, I had published some of them in a magazine that I was working for at the time, Wildlife in North Carolina. And I was asked to exhibit some of them, and I did. And I picked one particular picture at the very last minute. I wasn't real happy with it. It just seemed to be a snapshot. It was a picture of a couple of small workboats, small fishing boats coming in. Seemed like they were coming in at the end of an evening, end of a day. And I noticed that no one was stopping at my very elegantly composed scenics, but that picture seemed to stop a number of people in their tracks, and they poured. They looked at it very carefully and pointed to it. And finally, I asked a couple of them what was so important about that one picture. And they began to read the picture. This one particular man, Jimmy Amsbacher, who's a friend now down there, told me everything that I had never seen, and nor could I have ever known about that picture. He told me the history of the boats, the fact that it was one of the boats was built by a man named Ambrose Fulcher, who I became very well familiar with and as time went on. He told me many things about the picture and about the photograph, And I began to realize that maybe this was an interesting way of learning something about the culture of boat builders and fishermen in that part of the world, is by taking pictures of the boats and showing them to people, as I was doing with Jimmy Amsbacher that day, and having them tell me what they saw in the picture. What could I learn, in other words, if I did that?
Did they know about these particular boats, or was it the style of boat?
Yeah, that was the interesting thing, is that they knew they could tell me who built that boat, and they could tell me where it was built. And that surprised me, because I had forgotten where I had taken the picture. I had taken it in Atlantic, but I had forgotten that it was 20 years before that I had taken the picture and finally showed it and had forgotten where it was. So it was really surprising. And then the fact that they called it an Atlantic-type boat. And I said, you mean there are other type boats in other villages? And that got me thinking, wow, that's interesting. I wonder if anyone's done any work on this. So that's really the kind of precipitate cause of going ahead and doing this book.
So what did you learn? What is the difference between an Atlantic North Carolina boat and a Harker's Island boat?
Well, basically, they're very similar, because they have to travel the same and work the same water. The Core Sound and the Pamlico, to a lesser extent, is a very shallow body of water. Core Sound is no more than 10 feet in many spots. So it's got whatever boat floats has got to float in very shallow water. So their hull shapes are somewhat similar. I'm talking about the old style boats now, before motors came along. And basically there were two styles. One was the Atlantic style, which was in many respects very much like the Harker's Island style, which is the other style. But the Atlantic style had a cabin design that was very different from the Harker's Island design, and it had much to do with what kind of fish they were going after. And that was interesting to me, that the Atlantic boats were going out for a week at a time and were basically on the water for that long a time. They needed to be able to stand up. They needed to be able to have a little bit of room if there were three men on a boat for that length of time. The Harker's Island boats were sink netters, and so they were fishing maybe a day or two at a time and then coming in. They didn't need a whole lot of space in their cabins, and so their cabins were more squat. And the boat builders down there built for style and elegance, basically. They became very pretty boats and known for their elegance.
What was the status of boat builders, or is it, in those communities?
Today?
Yeah.
Atlantic boat building has ceased, and it has not been operating for probably 30 years. I mean, people might make a skiff or something like that, the big boats, the trawlers, or the work boats, the 40-footers that I was looking at and photographed, are not being made there. But there is a strong tradition of Harker's Island boat building, and has been for 50, 60, 70 years in Harker's Island. And that continues, although they have had to adapt to new demands. Very few people want a wooden boat any longer. They want something that's a little bit more plasticky and,
a little less maintenance and a little more
durable. Exactly. Right.
So what was the status in the old days when everybody depended on those in the days before motors? Boat builders had pretty high status in those places?
I think so, yeah, because, I think about one person that I spent a lot of time trying to uncover as much as I could about was the boat builder in Atlanta called Ambrose Fulcher. And he lived from 1865 to 1952. Nice long life, and he built a lot of boats. He claimed that he built over 1,000 hulls over his lifetime. And you have to think that maybe a lot of those hulls were being sought after by people in that particular area, Sea Level, Stacy, Cedar Island, those cluster of communities at that end of the Sound. So there was a lot of demand, which he and a handful of other people were fulfilling. There were other boat builders, of course, but someone who built that many boats, was fulfilling a demand that had to be there. Although it's interesting that he was reputed to build boats even when there wasn't a demand. He'd finish a boat and he'd start another one. It's kind of like one of those Victorian novelists who'd finish a novel in the morning and then write the end and then start the next one in the afternoon.
And as you say, probably most of the demand was from workers, from people who were actually working, fishing for a living. Not much demand for, do you think, for people from other parts of North Carolina or along the coast who might seek out a boat builder?
Well, in Harker's Island, there probably would be because they were closer to the mainland. So they probably had a lot of interest. But, you know, as we were talking about, a lot of the mainland areas had boat building traditions as well. So everyone built a boat in their backyard. If you wanted a boat, you just took care of your own need. But there were certain boats that fulfilled, a style or function so well that that people would go to them. So, I would say that most of the demand was homegrown or local, certainly regional, and not coming from far away for sure.
I think one of the great things about doing a project like this is all the stories that you must have heard surrounding these boats and boat makers. What were some of the more fascinating stories you heard?
Well, some of them were funny. I remember one story that fellow by the name of James Paul Lewis told me about a boat, a man named Mason, who lived in Atlantic, and he owned a boat named Louise. And he used to go up to Norfolk, Virginia a lot to sell his oysters. And finally, one year, he just stayed in Norfolk and stayed there. In fact, he stayed there for the next 20 years. And James Paul said he used to go up there and see him. He became a very good friend of his, he says. And then one year, he decided to come back to Atlantic. He docked his boat, went to his wife's house, and opened the front door and said, "What are we having for dinner?" And I thought that was really hysterical. It was kind of sad for the poor wife, but it has a ring of a certain kind of a folk tale about it. You know, it's a little too perfect, maybe.
And some of these other boats too. Are there stories about sort of the great storm that they survived and great kind of heroic episodes?
It's an interesting question because it's probably an area that I didn't get to as much as I could have. When I sat down with people, and very often they would invite me into their homes, I'd show them I had these pictures. I'd like to talk to them about them, and they say, "Oh yeah, come in. Very interested in talking about them." But my questions were always about the boats. They weren't about, "Can you tell me a story about your fishing?" But I did hear one particular story. In fact, it was had to do with a fishing exploit, not so much a storm, but a man named Leonard Goodwin was out fishing one time in winter, so it might have been oystering for that matter. And this is way back in maybe the 50s or even the 40s or something like that. He was an old man. He was fishing up to a couple of years ago, if you can imagine. There was a Navy plane that for some reason, whether it was out of pure malice or just faulty mechanism, jettisoned the bomb, went right through his boat and sunk it. So it's in the middle of the winter. He was by himself. He was out there for like 24 hours, freezing in this weather, holding on to the mast that he was in. And he was finally saved, but as he was telling me the story, he wept. It was like bringing it back again, the terror of that evening. As far as storms and great fishing exploits, there were a lot of those. You know, fishermen are like anybody else. They pride themselves on their skills, and a lot of fishermen would remember their big hauls. And one fisherman by the name of Danny Mason told me that he had caught 220,000 pounds of fish one time. He's a long haul fisherman, which means that they use two boats to tow a long net that comes together to form a kind of a corral. And the fish were penned up in there. Normally, it takes a run boat from the fish house a couple of hours to come out from the fish house, bail all the fish into their holds, and bring it back to the fish house. That's the normal routine. In this case, there were so many fish, it took many days before, and many runboats coming back and forth before they could pick them up.
What is the condition of the fishing industry today? What's going on there?
It's not very good. It has been, that's one of the kind of sad things when I look at that photograph that we were talking about before that people stopped at and looked at a lot. I realize a lot of things about it. One, that in 1985, when I took that picture, was very near the peak of the good fishing out there. One of my fisherman friends said all the world was fish at that time. Every time I went out, they'd have a huge haul, and a lot of people were fishing. That world has basically ended. There are a lot of factors involved, of course. Overfishing may well have played a big role, no doubt about it. It's a very human thing. You know, when things are good, grab for as much as you can get. But so that may have played a role, but there's a lot of other things. Climate change, foreign imported fish as undercutting native fish catches, pollution. At any rate, the fish don't seem to be there. The price of diesel fuel is sky high. You can't even afford to rev up your boat and get it out on the Sound.
I wonder what it was like when you came by and said you were interested in these boats as people are sort of managing this decline in their industry and their livelihood. What was your how were you received?
Oh, I was received very well. I mean, they obviously love these boats and they remember them. I think of them as a a boat is kind of like a memory bank. It it connects people one to the other. So as they are telling me about the boat, they're also telling me about their families and about the people who are other people who are connected with the boat, the people who repaired them, the communities where they were from. So yes, they were very hospitable. But still, it was sad to kind of contemplate. They were sad contemplating that world that they once lived in and enjoyed. And they would often say to me, even when I'm out in the town taking pictures of something, they'd say, "Well, you better get it while it lasts." So there's a kind of that kind of sense of bitterness about things, that they feel themselves as part of a lost culture.
Larry, it's a beautiful book. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Larry Early is a fine art photographer and writer. He's the author and photographer of the Workboats of Core Sound. Larry's going to be signing books at the annual Core Sound Waterfowl Weekend on Harkers Island, December 7th and 8th. You can find out more information at our website, stateofthings.org. You can also look at our website to see some of Larry's photographs of Workboats of Core Sound. Thanks for listening. Our website is stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Nicole Campbell, Alex Granados, Laura Lee, and Sean Wen. Robin Copley is the technical director. Brent Wolf is the news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stasio.